This is David Rovix, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step 3 is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
Welcome to the Climate Action Radio Show, which can be heard on Community Radio 3CR in Melbourne and Skid Row in Sydney. My name is Vivian Langford, and salut Babette. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and pay tribute to the decades-long legacy of Aboriginal fights for land rights and against the destructive mining projects that are fueling climate change.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high-quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Today's show brings you voices from Santa Marta. It hasn't caused much of a ripple in Australian media, but it was the world's first conference just focused on how to transition away from fossil fuels. It was hosted by the Government of Netherlands and the Government of Colombia in Santa Marta, Colombia. Here is part of the press conference with Stientje van Veldhoven, who's Netherlands Climate Minister, and Irene Vélez-Torres, the Environment Minister for Colombia.
This was not a negotiating conference, and therefore different parties, different countries have different positions. But in the conference report, we will make sure to reflect the richness of the discussion that we've had. On the commitment of countries, again, I think this really goes to the heart of the psychology of this process. These countries came together because they want to find a way to transition to a different economy. And we heard, for example, Nigeria speaking about this. We also heard about how Uruguay, through a country-wide dialogue, has set a 25-year plan. In the Netherlands also, we have closed the biggest gas field of Europe. So countries are taking steps, and each country is defining its roadmap because it knows that it needs to transition to a different economy. Nobody is going to force a country to a certain level of commitment. Everybody who's here is here because they want to move further than where they are right now, and they think that we can be stronger together. And that is why the psychology of this meeting is so important in actually driving the results of this conference. Together we can be stronger and we can go further, and that is where the results will come from. And then hand over to you.
And I will say that also in terms of what I take from this conference, the collective power that we have. At the beginning of the conference, we heard a lot about the ones that are missing, and we ended this conference saying the ones that are missing can still come in, they are welcome. But also we have a political power and economic power, and we are supported socially as well. And that should be sufficient to act.
Hi, my name is Lucas. I'm a journalist with Argus Media. My question is about national oil companies, especially here in Latin America. National oil companies account for around 50% of all emissions globally, and they weren't really present here. I want to know if there's a plan, or at least a plan for them to be more present in the next conference and in the next talks.
How do we deal with national oil companies? We have a national oil company. And in general, what we are seeing is that it should be part of the roadmap, because this is where the production takes place. So we hope that the countries can think about how their own companies should be included and should have targets of transition.
And here is Ana Carolina González Espinosa, a prominent climate leader in Latin America and one who led the talks on global energy at Santa Marta.
Santa Marta opened a very important conversation for oil and gas producing countries in the global south. The conversation about energy independence, land instability, and the importance of inclusive development. And it also brought in important actors that are often missing in these conversations, like subnational governments. It also left an important blind spot, the absence of participation of national oil companies. And these are not minor players. They produce half of the oil production around the globe. And their production is projected to grow to 62% by 2050. They also play a major role in economies like in countries like Nigeria, Colombia, or Mexico. So any next steps in this conversation needs to include them as part of a very credible roadmap in transitioning away from fossil fuels.
To give you a taste of how this conference was innovative, here's Rachel Kite, the UK Special Representative. She said, "I have to say, it's really nice to sit in a small circle. In a negotiation, it's very, very fast moving and transactional. But now we have had 2 days to think about fossil fuel transition issues and this only. There were closed door sessions where, for example, 12 members of parliament from around the world sat in a circle. And in an outer circle around them sat members of civil society, such as trade unionists, indigenous, and community representatives." Here's Juan Carlos Monterrey Gomez from Panama. He said, "They put us in a format where we could not open our computers, so we had to speak from our minds and our hearts. That completely flipped my perception. That kind of space I haven't seen in my 10 years history with the UNFCCC. It was not a space for negotiations, but a forum to discuss the practical steps, how to move away from fossil fuels. In the past, countries have pledged how much they can contribute to lowering their national emissions. But at Santa Marta, those countries willing to make the transition went away to plan a roadmap, which, as Irene Vélez-Torres said, quote, must be very clear and honest about emissions exported from producing countries. And doesn't that point the finger at us? Australia was there, but so far our representative has declined to speak to me, and I'm really wondering if Australia has any intention to create a roadmap or a plan to phase out our coal and gas exports." The tone was set by President Gustavo Petro, who began by describing the flying rivers of the Amazon rainforest and what's at stake if we keep up our dependence on hydrocarbons. He talks of fascism and the unity of peoples, not states, and not the United Nations, which will counteract that fascism. To me, it's a bit like the idea of people's assemblies promoted by Extinction Rebellion. Imagine a European people's assembly to phase out dependence on coal, oil, and gas, which would be taken seriously by the states of Europe, locked into their party politics. Anyway, here's a part of Gustavo Petro's speech in translation.
"The letter that thousands of scientists from the panel of experts sent to COP30, which was held in Belém de Pará, in the magical, incredible place where the Amazon River, an ocean of fresh water, meets the saltwater ocean of the Atlantic, which makes up the system, is one of the mechanisms by which the Amazon rainforest exists, is the immense steam that is created there, which is created upstream and reaches, among other things, the high mountains of the Eastern Mountain Range and is converted into water, a good part of the drinking water and fresh water in general consumed in the Andes, comes from the flying rivers of the Amazon rainforest. That humidity is what allows the exuberance and diversity of the rainforest. And if that humidity does not exist for whatever reason, the Amazon rainforest does not exist. And that is the third climatic pillar of the world. If one thinks about the oceans and thinks about the large blocks of ice, these jungles that are south of Colombia and that are in the heart of South America are the third climatic pillar. Without it, we will reach the point of no return. The Amazon rainforest is burning. The records of life in the ocean show that it is diminishing substantially and rapidly. This is a world-class coal exporter. Colombia is the fifth largest coal exporter in the world. Exports are falling more and more. It is one of the specific problems that we face in this government and in the years to come. As the fifth largest exporter in the world, Colombia has been living for 50 years off the foreign exchange from oil and coal, that is, fossil fuels, to give them a name. When its society is a society of farmers, this region has the largest mines in America and competes with the largest in the world. At COP30, the scientific report that says that 75% of the climate crisis is due to the extraction and consumption of hydrocarbons, which are basically coal, oil, and gas, was not taken into account. One question that needs to be asked is whether capitalism can really adapt to a non-fossil energy mode. What I see in my practice is that there is resistance, inertia, in the power, and in the economy of this archaic energy mode. Today, the fossil that leads to death. No doubt, capital could kill itself, humanity with it, and all life itself on this planet now. Obviously, humanity cannot allow that, and we are going towards barbarism, and barbarism is the prelude or the way of being of fascism. If what we are witnessing is the deepening of barbarism, then the response has to be immediate, has to be the unity of peoples, not just of states. The unity of states failed in the COPs and in the UN because it has not fallen into impotence to resolve the war and to resolve this climate crisis. Power does not mean kneeling before barbarism and remaining silent, because there is no alternative. Barbarism will lead us to waste time, and that crucial and vital time will lead to the clock of life on the planet running out. And so, empowerment would now imply the unity of peoples. It would imply the brotherhood of cultures. It would imply the construction of the human fabric with or without the help of the states. And it would imply a mobilization, as has already been achieved in some cases, a mobilization that this time is a mobilization for life in general, where women, I believe, could have a greater space, given that their way of being allows them, their essence allows them to feel life more than we do. And that means that women have to come to the forefront.
Santa Marta's work will feed into the next United Nations Climate Conference in Turkey, then to another one like this, hosted this time by Tuvalu from the Global South and the Government of Ireland from the North. Later we'll hear Elisa Morguera, who attended the Santa Marta Conference, but first, in a tribute to 3CR's 50th birthday, here is Fergus Green from the 3CR Archive. I interviewed him in 2015, just before the landmark Paris Climate Conference.
He co-authored a report a few years ago called Laggards to Leaders, with avant-garde ideas like getting the handful of coal-exporting nations together to manage the necessary steps away from a fossil-fueled economy. That's what I took from it. He's now at the London School of Economics. He specialises in climate change policy and the role governments can play in fostering structural economic change. So welcome, Fergus.
Thanks very much, Vivian. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah. First, fill us in what's been happening in the global scene and with yourself in your studies about climate policy.
Sure. So I've focused on a few key areas over the last 2 years that I've been working in London. One of those areas has been on international climate change cooperation, particularly in the lead up to the Paris conference, which is now only 5 or 6 weeks away. And there, you know, we've sort of seen the shift away, I think, from this kind of utopian attempt to get a broad and deep comprehensive treaty towards a more manageable task, which is sort of a broad and shallow treaty, which I think puts the spotlight back on countries to find their own decarbonisation pathways. And I've also focused a lot on China and China's changing economy and what that means for, particularly for China's emissions, but it also has huge implications for Australia, which I'm going to be talking a bit about while I'm here. And the third area that I've worked on, particularly in my work with Professor Stern, has focused on the economics of climate change action. And there, the really big shift has kind of been from focusing on climate change purely as a matter of costs for countries, which need to be avoided and minimised, to recognising, first of all, the way that costs can fall rapidly over time with the right structures in place, but also on the associated benefits of taking climate action, quite aside from avoiding climate change itself. And so we've done a lot of really interesting work on the broader economic benefits and costs of countries taking action on climate change. And I think they've all been areas that have really changed enormously in the last few years.
Well, It's hard to see a historical shift when you're right in the middle of it. And listeners might think, well, actually, we're on a path to becoming the Saudi Arabia of gas in Australia. We're going to still, you know, exploit coal. We're still subsidising it. And I think when you hear, you think there's no change at all. And I wanted to know what would motivate or what will motivate the transition for exporting countries like us towards renewable energy. So what would motivate that?
Well, I think the biggest thing that will drag us into change, whether we prepare for it or not, is the changing economics of fossil fuel energy versus renewable energy. The economics of coal are already bad when you factor in the full costs, which tend not to get factored in through taxation and so on. But what will increasingly happen is, even if we don't price in those full costs, so the local air pollution and the greenhouse gas pollution and so on, is that just the economics of renewable energy, particularly solar and wind, are getting better and better every year, and many countries are opting to push forward with investing in renewable energy ahead of investing in fossil fuels. The biggest change in that regard is from our largest trading partner, China. Which, you know, over the period 2000 to 2013, went on a huge coal kind of binge, for want of a better word, as part of powering its sort of investment-driven economy. And from 2008 became a net coal importer, and Australia obviously supplied a lot of that coal to China. Well, China's now turned a corner, and its coal use is falling for a range of reasons we can go into if you want. But basically, the sort of key takeaway is that it's going to be importing a lot less coal and using a lot less coal, and it's going to be using a lot more renewable energy. So I think the economics of this around the world will change the situation for Australia, and we can kind of either adapt and capitalise on the opportunities, or we can sort of be left holding the coal mines, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your previous work, you took heart from a treaty to preserve Antarctica, and I believe we starred there. Could you remind us how Australia did take a lead at that time, and then tell us what sort of treaty you want to see now emerging from the Paris Climate Conference?
Mm. Yeah, so the Antarctic example is a really interesting one, and it was during the period when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister of Australia. And what was the issue then was this question of whether and to what extent governments wanted to allow mining in the pristine environment of Antarctica. And an original proposal was tabled to allow allow mining, basically with some restrictions. And and Bob Hawke, actually against the wishes of most of his cabinet, decided that this wouldn't do, and along with the French president, kind of mobilised a coalition among the international community to actually impose some of the highest environmental restrictions ever in any international treaty, including a ban on Antarctic mining. And it's an interesting case study for a few reasons. One, because it shows that actually we do have a history of banning certain things that we think are just totally unacceptable. And I think where it provides the most useful precedent is perhaps not so much for the kind of international agreement we're likely to see in Paris, which is likely to be sort of very broad but quite thin, but for potentially for other kinds of cooperation that small groups of countries could do who are willing to go for more kind of, if you like, narrow and deep cooperation. And one example that could be potentially important here is around coal production and coal exports. We've seen that the president of Kiribati and the Pacific Islands Forum recently call for a moratorium on new coal mines and mine extensions. This is more similar in structure to the kind of Antarctic ban. And that's the kind of thing that I think Australia should be engaging in, frankly. And a lot of other countries are going to be increasingly calling for us if they want to avoid two degrees or more of global warming. So we should get in front of that.
Yeah. We're speaking to Fergus Green, and Fergus is from the London School of Economics. Fergus, what could Australia offer at Paris, even if it did stick with the low targets? Now, we've just had a change of Prime Minister. He's much more positive about climate change, much more knowledgeable about it. And I wondered if there couldn't be quite a few other policies he could offer that would impress the world community that we are intending to help our neighbours, as you said, you know, the Suva Declaration, and help our neighbours with clean energy, developing renewable energy as an export maybe. But what could he offer or our team offer at Paris?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think if you sort of take for a given the sort of political feasibility constraints within the Liberal National Coalition, it seems that Turnbull has been determined to kind of portray business as usual as continuing, and so he's not going to be introducing any major new policies. So it doesn't leave a lot of room to manoeuvre, but I think, you know, one area that he's clearly highlighted is of potential, is of great interest to him personally, and I know this for a fact to be true, is around technological innovation generally, and particularly around climate change, around renewable energy and electrified transport and so on. I know that he gets this issue better than most and is very engaged with it. And it's an area where we're probably not likely to see much in the formal Paris Treaty, but where we could see, I mentioned before about smaller groups of countries cooperating, collaborating on various things. Well, one area that a lot of governments, including the UK government, are promoting quite heavily is enhanced technology cooperation, which can come in various forms, and I won't go to the ins and outs, but basically I think there could be potential for engaging a Malcolm Turnbull, also engaging a sort of a David Cameron and some of these sort of centre-right figures around a technological innovation agenda. Now, that, of course, would still have potential budgetary implications for Australia, but it's the sort of thing that I feel like a Malcolm Turnbull could potentially have some room to manoeuvre in Paris.
Fergus, tell us about the renewable energy superpower idea. At the moment, I'd suppose we're one of the superpowers for coal exports. Saudi Arabia exports oil. Those are superpowers for energy, but what's this vision of renewable energy superpowers, and who are they likely to be?
We can sort of start with the end game, which is in a renewable-based energy system. Yeah. And there, I think, is a very strong case that Australia, if it plays its cards well, would have huge advantages internationally, because in a world where, you know, the majority of countries are using majority renewable energy, then the cost of renewable energy becomes the key determinant of whether you have an advantage in cheap electricity, which of course is important for lots of manufacturing industries and so for economic competitiveness. So it sort of turns on this head, on its head, this idea that, well, renewables are more costly, and so we'd be losing our electricity advantage. Because in the end game, we would actually have a greater advantage because we have such good renewable energy resources. So I think the analysis of that phase is really interesting and important, and says that, you know, we could be a low-cost energy provider in a world of renewable energy.
Yeah, why would it be especially low-cost from Australia? You mean exporting energy, like through a pipeline?
Well, no. Well, that's sort of not so much the pipeline, but the idea being that for energy-intensive producers of you know, goods like steel, aluminium, things like that, industries where the cost of energy is one of the largest costs of production, they will, other things being equal, tend to want to locate themselves in countries which have relatively low-cost energy. Now, there are lots of complicating factors. It depends on a range of other things, but Australia, you know, has a lot of the other good things that you would want, you know, and that's why we have a lot of those industries already. Now, in addition to that, and there will be additional industrial opportunities associated with the storage and potential export of energy commodities. And here we talk about things like biofuels, about hydrogen, and to some extent exporting electricity directly through undersea cables to Southeast Asia. I mean, we already do it from the mainland of Victoria to Tasmania as part of the national energy market, but it would require longer undersea cables, and the economics of that may become favourable to tap Australia's renewable resources. So they're the kind of two components of that future. But the report also talks about the transitional phase, and it makes the really important point that when you're building renewable energy generation sources, all of the investment comes in the capital cost of building the new building the new infrastructure, and there's very, very low ongoing running costs. You obviously don't have fuel costs. So that makes the profile, the kind of financial profile and economic profile of those technologies very different from fossil fuels, where you're constantly supplying the fuel. And over the next 15, 20 years, when we're going to need to see, and I think we'll increasingly see, major investments globally in renewable energy, that means there's going to be a relatively short window where most of the investment will come, and then they'll all be running and there'll be no additional fuel costs. So the point is that Australia needs to kind of get in on the action in that transitional phase to supply equipment, materials, services, expertise, intellectual property for the development of renewable energy in other countries. And that's kind of the third piece of the puzzle.
Still fighting for what is ours.
Climate action. Climate justice.
No man know the time, know the hour.
In December, the governments of 190 countries arrive in Paris to discuss a new global agreement to stop dangerous climate change. Tricia joins their discussions with a series of special interviews and analysis.
In a tribute to 3CR's 50th birthday, here is Fergus Green from the 3CR archive. I interviewed him in 2015.
How will the energy revolution affect nations in a political sense? I'm thinking of the oil wars that we've had and that we're still having, and the water wars of the future that people say we will have. How do you think, will this make a less tense future politically, or more tensions?
Yeah, I think that throughout the 20th century and earlier, a lot of the major global and regional conflicts we've seen have had a strong resource dimension, particularly a strong oil dimension, that has to do with this enormous imbalance and kind of inequality we see in the in endowments of fossil fuel resources, particularly of oil resources, which are concentrated in a few countries. And in a renewable energy based sort of global energy system, or lots of sort of national and regional energy systems, those advantages narrow quite substantially. There's still a differential. This is kind of the where Australia can capitalize, but you won't have those kind of extreme imbalances in the location of energy. And so, you know, I think, you know, other things being equal, that would significantly reduce the potential for geopolitical tensions. So I think this, you know, there's so many, to sort of use an economist word, externalities that we don't even think about as externalities associated with the fossil energy system, and we don't think about them as externalities because they're hard to measure and quantify, let alone monetize. But they're there. They're there in the costs of the kind of military and security costs associated with the import and export of oil, and sort of military adventurism associated with oil. They're there in the kind of costs of having a political economy dominated by large state-owned and multinational private oil companies. So, you know, we tend to sort of forget about those, but in a world which is much more decentralized renewable energy, we will kind of avoid those sort of costs, in inverted commas, which are sort of huge social and political costs.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are, and you're going to have to be generous, and that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together. Yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person. Terrible. They haven't grown, they haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
Now here is the wonderful UN rapporteur, Elisa Morguera. Elisa Morguera is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Climate Change and Human Rights. She's also Professor of International Law at Durham University, where she organized a forum from Durham to Santa Marta, and we talked to her in April. So welcome, Elisa. It's only 3 weeks since the first international conference on the just transition away from fossil fuels in Santa Marta, and now you're in Fiji. So thank you so much for doing this program. Our listeners will love to hear an update from you. And first of all, just tell us what it was like there, especially participating in those small groups. Well, I think they had different rules from the COP. You know, it was a more, perhaps a more free-flowing conversation there. Tell us what it was like.
Yeah, thank you so much, Vivian, for having me back in your podcast. And yeah, it's good to reflect on Santa Marta. I think that generally everyone who was there seemed to appreciate the opportunity to be having a conversation, an explicit conversation on fossil fuel phase out. So I think that was kind of a general sense of how important it is to have these conversations, even if they're difficult. And so in a way, a confirmation that it's not really helpful for the UN climate process to instead, you know, avoid having the conversation. I think also the focus on looking at the economics, different economic challenges and approaches to phasing out fossil fuels was appreciated, because this is really very much on the minds of different states, looking into this and understanding how different states will face different challenges in this path. That said, the proper conference where we had member states representative wasn't as open as I had expected. And in fact, partly because of logistics, but I think partly to keep the conversations more kind of open among states, many experts, including myself, were not invited into the closed conversation. So this is a pity, I think, not to be able to have witnessed that and have, you know, reflected on how we could do it even better next time around. There was a selection of experts from civil society, including most affected groups, to contribute to some of this conversation, but there was a limited number also of civil society in the room. So in a way, I think the full potential of Santa Marta to be in a really inclusive process and also testing more conversation between states and other experts has not been fully tested. And I think this is a bit of a missed opportunity.
Yes, but they can build on that in the next conference in Tuvalu with Ireland as the North, Global North partner. I just loved the sound of it. And I saw many bits and pieces on YouTube, which were available to the public, a lot of inspiring speeches there. And just the innovative way that perhaps hard conversations were able to be had and perhaps networks were able to be made between people. I feel it must be, there must be some positive outcomes from it. But before Santa Marta, I was racking my brains, look, how, you know, this whole thing of how do we make the transition? And some people were saying it's just not that hard. You just stop the subsidies. And in Australia's case, you stop exporting coal and gas. And, you know, it's simple. But other people said we just need a treaty, as we've had treaties about proliferation of other things. We can have that non-proliferation of fossil fuel treaty. But I don't think that was the achievement of this summit. It wasn't really those two things that came out as to-do items on countries' list. They came up with the idea of global, with roadmaps and a global roadmap, which we won't talk about now, but, you know, that I think those ideas seem to, from people I've talked to, seem to come out. But what surprised you? And were you happy with the integration of human rights into the sessions? Were they taking human rights seriously as the basis of any, you know, decisions that might eventually be made?
Unfortunately not. So I was hoping, you know, because of all the preparatory work, but also the contributions of human rights experts on fossil fuels and on climate justice, but also on helping to prevent negative impacts. But unfortunately, that framing wasn't there. And there were also not really references to how we have to take action on fossil fuels. That's also in line with the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice on protecting the environment and state obligations on climate change. So I think, again, there was a missed opportunity to rely on international law and particularly human rights to have, you know, the most comprehensive and well-informed discussion. So that again, maybe I'm really hoping that Tuvalu and Ireland will rather center the human rights framing in the next conference and really, you know, show the benefits also of an approach that's not quite taken in the climate COP either, to show how much that helps with having the right conversations and the most, you know, meaningful conversations on fossil fuels as well.
There were two people's assemblies there as well. And someone, listeners will know, Australian listeners, Larissa Baldwin-Roberts from the Banjalung Nation, she was quoted as saying, you want our pictures, not our voices. And that's been the thing with the COPs, you know, the very colourful COPs with all these people represented, but they're not in the main sessions, the main decision-making things. Yeah, you want our photos, not our voices. What were your observations about frontline people, not just Indigenous people, but people on the front lines? Were you in sessions with them, or did you hear much of their voice in the actual conference?
For the conference among states, there were the academic conference and also the People Summit, and I was able to participate in some sessions. And I think there we could see definitely efforts to integrate different knowledge systems and also understand the experiences of people to really provide that, you know, most integrated advice to states. There was some level of engagement, both with this preparatory parts of the conference in the intergovernmental section and some participation of representatives from these different conversations into the small groups. But I think, you know, again, perhaps because there wasn't so much time to prepare for this conference, it wasn't necessarily the most inclusive way. And I think many also participants from civil society and from Indigenous peoples and others felt that, you know, they put so much effort and also their own financial resources to be in Santa Marta. And they also put a lot of effort into the written submissions, but it wasn't necessarily a very clear sense that everyone was being heard and how exactly these contributions would be shaping the work among states. So I think, again, a lot of lessons learned of how this could be done in more meaningful ways, but also ways in which everyone feels that their contribution matters, that this is good use of very scarce resources, both in civil society, Indigenous groups, as well as in academia.
Well, you're right. It's terribly hard to get to Santa Marta. The cost of getting there for many people in, lots of situations, extremely hard. They put all their effort to get there. I was wondering, how is this being reported back to the public? You know, is there a booklet from this, a report or a film, or, you know, how is it reported back?
Yeah, so a report of the conference is being prepared, which will make public. There was also an effort to synthesize the written submission. And this was done kind of during the conference itself, but I understand that this was a synthesis that was AI generated. Okay. And there were some concerns about how potentially there were some biases in how the submissions were summarized, some also deeper concerns about certain key contributions being misunderstood in that summary. So again, a lot of lessons learned about how this is careful work, the bringing together of views, understanding any tensions, also among the advisor areas of science. This is the work that we need to do.
Yeah, because so many people that I interview say to me, you know, people in these NGOs or government positions, they say, well, it has to come from the grassroots. You know, the pressure and the knowledge has to come from the grassroots. And I think the grassroots need more help publicising, even doing radio, even doing films. You know, they need help. And I'd love to see a bit more of that.
Hello, I'm Rory McLeod. I live in Scotland and I love radio. I can do the washing up, I could be in the garden, I could be in the car driving. Well, I'm listening to 3CR, Radical Radio. It's a subscription radio, community radio on 855 AM. We do stream at 3cr.org.au. So you can become a member and donate money.
But as a special rapporteur, you must be acutely aware of how extractivist companies and states violate human rights. You know, you've written a bit about that. And I include here, on top of fossil fuels, I include the green extractivism like lithium and other minerals, which is quite big in South America. Would you give us some examples from your traveling around and people you meet, and just examples, tell the listeners how those sort of extractivist activities impact people and communities.
Yes, I mean, last year I devoted a whole report to how, in the context of the energy transition, there can be situations when we are violating human rights, and in addition, we're even harming the climate or nature, which also contributes to climate regulation. I think the highest risk of human rights violation is when we have mega projects, and that can be particularly like mega hydropower plants, but sometimes we also see this in terms of mega solar power plants or mega wind farms. And the problems there is that we, I think many states try to go very quickly. Sometimes they even exempt those projects from public consultations and from environmental impact assessment. So it's another example where maybe, you know, we're trying to advance to respond to the urgency of the climate issue, but we are cutting short all the opportunities we have to do the best possible job, to plan those renewables developments in a way that prevents harm to nature, that prevents harm to people, that prevents harm to water and food, which we also need to protect with highest attention because they are harmed by climate change itself. And local people, farmers, indigenous peoples, have the knowledge, the local understanding to, advise how this project can be developed. But there's also an economics aspect, which is this priority we're allocating to large-scale projects and large-scale economic actors. And we should learn from the fossil fuel-based economy that often those large-scale projects don't really deliver, improve energy access for those who have been not served by fossil fuels. They might even serve certain uses that are harmful to the environment and economic sector. So we should also look into decentralized energy production and ways in which we integrate renewables with food systems and with other uses of the land or of the ocean. So again, it really shows how the inclusiveness of the decision-making process is a precondition.
An example I've heard of that is where in Mexico, I think there were AI, what are these big data centers that take a lot of water, use a lot of water. And apparently some of these were built in the north of Mexico, huge ones, and the local people have no potable water. And so that's a pure example of, well, is the AI that we're all benefiting from is not even allowing those local, robbing those people of just the most basic thing.
There's no transparency about how we decide which projects go ahead, why they're placed in a certain areas, including areas that are water poor, that are already negatively affected by climate change. In some cases, both developments can be also very energy intensive. So the transparency about the decisions, but also making sure that these projects are really responding to people's needs is essential. So once I think particularly the data center is really raising a lot of questions because they're growing everywhere. They're also kind of being exempted from checks and consultations. And they themselves emit a lot of emissions. They also use a lot of energy. And so even the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Water has called for a moratorium on new data centers until we have clarity about why we need so many, how are we deciding where to build in them, and how communities are having an opportunity to assess together with public authorities all possible impacts and all possible benefits. Mm-hmm. Very often it's not clear to whose benefit those data centers are being built for.
No, the 1%, as some people would say, for the elite who can afford a computer, for example, who can afford to fly around the world and all of this. A lot of the emissions are from a top group of people who the lower majority of the world can't ever live that lifestyle. But I'm just thinking of examples, human rights examples, impacts of climate change. We all know the terrible disasters of climate change. But when you're talking about talking to those conferences, what sort of information do you want them most to know, from all your research?
Yeah, and I think this is actually a really good example also about the information we need in the second conference on phasing out fossil fuels. I think that the most helpful information is about impacts on our right to health. And that's true for the impact of fossil fuels on our right to health, because we know that they affect every single organ in our body through our life course. In fact, they even affect children before they're born when they're in the maternal womb. And that's both fossil fuels themselves and air pollution. It's plastics, it's toxic substances, in our food systems through pesticides and also, again, the use of packaging. And so that kind of helps to really think the phase out of fossil fuels is not only a matter of energy transition, but it's a matter of full, you know, rethinking our economic models. Why are we so dependent on fossil fuels? Well, in all their forms, they harm our health. And equally, when we look at solutions, how do we move into renewables? We have the evidence to show where renewables are more supportive also of human health, including in terms of access to healthy foods and sufficient water, and where maybe certain renewables projects may be harming our health. And that evidence is available to us, but it's often not necessarily, we don't necessarily have, you know, health experts as part of this conversation. And yeah, in Santa Marta, even in the academic conference, we had a separate track on the health evidence, as opposed to having part of every other track of conversation, so that we could test whether any solution or any economic analysis holds ground if we think of negative impacts on health, because that's definitely not a price we can pay to make meaningful action on the energy transition.
What were the leading ideas there, you know, the hopeful ideas that you heard about?
Yeah, well, one key finding was how, if we consider the health benefits and public savings of moving away from fossil fuels, most countries would recoup any public investment in the transition in a year's time. So that's quite incredible, because we often hear about, you know, what will be the economic sacrifices of moving away from fossil fuels. But in fact, the health benefits are such that in terms of, you know, overall public budget of our countries, we will be very quickly saving ourselves the costs of so much human health harm, you know, from climate change, from other impacts of fossil fuels. And I think that in itself changes the cost-benefit analysis in very significant ways.
Yes, and I would love to have more media on this, more public propaganda, like you said, public education on this, because I know we're not going to talk about the roadmaps, and it was lucky you warned us in April, oh, they're not going to have a roadmap. And I think all the mainstream media who suddenly realized the Santa Marta conference was on practically the day it started and said, oh, and there's no roadmap, and Russia wasn't there, and China wasn't there. And, you know, that was all the headline, but there was so much that was there, which I really wanted to report, and you told us. But I noticed Leeds University, in collaboration with Colombian Environment Department, they did a draft roadmap, and they found that for $10 billion per year, this is the investment needed, they'd have to get private investment, $10 billion per year. By the year 2040, they would be saving $23 billion a year. And I told this to somebody just today, and he said, oh, that'll never happen. That won't happen. How can that happen? And I think it's because things are unthinkable. There's no media about it. People don't explain it to you. You think, oh, yes, that won't happen. But these are pragmatic things, aren't they? They're not just idealistic. It's pragmatic to save your health. It's pragmatic to save money and not waste it, especially in a country like Colombia that exports coal, and coal's going down. You know, they won't be getting the revenue, so they need to be thinking of something else. And I thought that was wonderful how Leeds University did that. And just coming back to your Durham conference, did many of the academics there have good ideas about how they can help this transition, either by making these roadmaps or by just helping aspects of it with the countries who might be unable to even think about it right now?
Yeah, and I think the key point about these roadmaps is that they should not be drawn on a limited set of analysis, be that as a limited set of, you know, economic cost-benefit analysis, but also a broader set of understanding of what are the barriers and what are the solutions. So a big conversation in Santa Marta, which was not made very prominent in the outcomes, for instance, how we need to move away from an undue protection of foreign companies who are very much leading still expansion of fossil fuels, and who can even sue countries if they try to, you know, advance on the phasing out of fossil fuel. And that even happened to Colombia during the Santa Marta conference. So this is an issue, like a legal barrier that's been created in international law since the 70s that we need to remove. if any state can be free to effectively protect human rights and take meaningful climate action. But it's not something that we discuss in the UN climate process. It's another area of international law, and yet it's indispensable to advance, you know, even in the implementation of the roadmaps. But there are other areas, you know, working with those working on AI, working with those on, you know, health and water. And I think also working with the kind of the political economy, looking at how our cost of living at the moment are rising because of those rising fossil fuel prices, despite continued subsidies, and really having then that, you know, the kind of the imagination of saying, what would our life be like and our day-to-day cost of living be like if we were moving away from subsidizing fossil fuels and then having to pay such high prices, which are due to that the kind of the volatility of the global supply chain as well.
Yes. Oh, and look, the historians of 2026 are going to have to mention how we had the Straits of Hormuz, that story playing out, it's still going, and the oil shortage there and the shock going through people not being able, fertilizer being held up, all sorts of things being held up by that war situation, and this little conference being the first in the world where we're actually saying, how do we move away from that? Whereas we've had 30 years, everyone keeps commenting, 30 years of UN. But I think we needed the 30 years just to get to this point. Somehow I'm not so critical. I can see how that UN thing, UN process works also. And I'd wonder what you're going to report to the United Nations. What's the key messages? Not that you're going to reveal now to us what your report will be, but what are you going to say to them about to the United Nations, what COPs, what needs to be incorporated?
Yeah, and I think, you know, these are recommendations already made in my report last year that we need the UN climate COP to have, you know, to make progress on climate mitigation, which has not been the case for the last few COPs, and to have an explicit conversation about fossil fuels, not only in the energy sector, but also, for instance, in agriculture. And again, last year, no decision was taken on agriculture, even if it is the second economic sector contributing to climate change. And then everything we've learned about, you know, the importance of the health evidence, the human rights impacts, the economic inequality, that must be part of the conversation. This is not just a technological fix, because we have, this is both part of the science that we need to put on the table to make good decisions, also to show how these decisions are supportive of multiple public policy objectives, but also to prevent mistakes from happening again, foreseeable negative impacts from happening. And now, you know, COP30 had a good decision on the just transition, looking at how we need to respect human rights, including the human rights of indigenous peoples, of women, of small-scale farmers. So this kind of shows how this applies in the specific context of the energy transition and beyond, how our food systems also need to transition to a place we're not dependent on fossil fuels in all their form.
It's so interesting talking to you. But my last question is about the media and the narrative. You know, at the University of Magdalena, they had 11 work streams and 400 academics I read were there. Did any of them focus on the cultural gatekeepers who prevent the narrative, this narrative that you're telling me and many people I interview who really care and see the bigger scientific picture and the imperative and the urgency? That narrative doesn't really get through properly. And there's a lot of people paying, probably a lot. I think they are paying a lot to keep a false solutions and false ideas floating about. And I think the cultural gatekeepers I see are the media and the universities themselves. You know, sometimes they keep a lid on the ideas that are being promoted. So did they have a stream on that, or was there a serious discussion of the media and the cultural gatekeepers?
Well, there was a discussion about climate disinformation and obstruction. And again, we have scientific evidence showing a track record of over 60 years of climate disinformation. But, you know, we have to understand that both the media, universities, PR companies are being paid by fossil fuel companies, by petrochemical companies, even by the largest meat and dairy producers to disinform the public about, you know, both the problems that they're causing and, you know, the solutions that should be prioritized. So this is very well documented. We know that there is basically an irreconcilable conflict of interest between those sectors of the business community who are part of the fossil fuel-based economy. We know by the number of lobbyists at the climate COP, even at the plastics negotiations, how much power they have, how present in numbers they are, and how they can even lead to a complete stall of negotiations among states. And again, in the UN climate process, we don't have really a process of dealing with conflict of interest. So Santa Marta had a process. There was a need to declare any conflict of interest, including whether you receive any funding from fossil fuel companies. And that was also true for academics. This is a standard conduct for instance, the medical profession. They always have to declare if they're being funded by an industry that would have a conflict of interest with their work. And of course, we need much more than that to make sure that that, you know, continues to be the case for the second conference in Tuvalu. But also we need that in our UN processes. We need a very careful and explicit policy to prevent conflict of interest. And we know that that has slowed climate action, and that may explain in great part why, as you say, then the public is not informed. And this disinformation in and of itself is a form of violation of our human right to information, to science, to education, and eventually to public participation in decision-making processes.
Yes, to me it's like in the middle of a bushfire, the radio coming on with information about the wrong place to go, you know, that sort of thing. It's as dangerous as that. And I wondered if how consciously maybe the Santa Marta people were talking about making their own media. Was there any appetite for making your own media, for, you know, inspiring, for, you know, I'm with community radio, that's probably a small influence, but there's many other types of media, including quite a lot of independent media. Was there any talk of that, you know, that we need to grab the narrative and tell a different story?
I don't think that was present in the Santa Marta process so much, and I agree with you that maybe it should be more central and explicit in the next conference. I mean, for sure, states have multiple obligations to ensure that the media contribute to that access to information, and media outlets, PR companies have also their own human rights responsibilities not to contribute to climate disinformation. So there are multiple human rights responsibilities, and everyone needs to play a part. For university as well, they have a responsibility to disclose where their funding is coming from, to be very clear if they're receiving funding from fossil fuel companies, and again, really, you know, be very clear about these conflicts of interest.
Yeah. Well, there's obviously a lot of work to do, a lot of work to be doing ongoing, isn't there? And I hope, was that on balance a great thing for you or a disappointing thing?
I think it was a mix. There were, you know, the fact that the conference happened is very positive. The fact that we could see that this different model was working and we could pilot approaches to address some of the longstanding concerns we have with the UN climate process, all of that is positive, but we need to build on that. And I think also we need to be frank and constructive about what didn't work or didn't work according to expectations, particularly if we expect so many actors to put their resources, to volunteer their time to support this process.
Yes.
And of course, we need states as well to be living up to this, you know, genuine but constructive critiques to strengthen this process more and more.
Yes. Well, I don't think the Australian government had a government represent. They had someone from the civil service, but not a parliamentarian. And I think actually in the end, it might be better if the government would offer scholarships or pay for people to go, because I can't see how some of these non-governmental groups, and especially the Indigenous groups, can even afford to go to those conferences and prepare. But that's for a future discussion. Thank you very much, Elisa. We've been talking to Professor Elisa Morguera, who's given us her time, and now she's in Fiji. I just hope you can have a lovely, restful evening now after this and ever onward. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I'll leave the last word to Shiva Gundan, head of the Greenpeace delegation at Santa Marta. Santa Marta was a breath of fresh air and a sign that the wind is finally shifting. But a signal is not a solution. When we go to Tuvalu, the conversation has to change. Not just ambition, but proof of implementation. Thanks tonight to Professor Elisa Morguera for reporting on the Santa Marta Conference, to Irene Vélez-Torres, Ana Carolina González-Espinosa, and Stientje van Veldhoven for their leadership at the conference, as well as President Gustavo Petro, whose successor I do not know at the time of recording, but whose work and inspiration will certainly go on. And thanks to 3CR for their archives, and also Professor Fergus Green, who is riding the tide of the energy transition and is still taking climate action. My name is Vivian Langford. Goodbye and good luck.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared. It's coal. It's coal.
Tune in every Monday at 5 p.m. to hear the Climate Action.